However, today's business is, of course, to welcome András Schuri, who is at the University of Vienna. And András is a good friend of the faculties in sales. He's been working with Professor John Spencer on a number of issues, but more particularly on the proposal for a European public prosecutor. It's a real pleasure to welcome you back and to give today's lunchtime seminar. I should say that the paper upon which the talk is based will be coming out very soon in the issues of the European studies, so it's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kenneth, for the introduction and even more for the kind invitation to give this talk today. And I would like to welcome all of you as well, especially Professor John Spencer, who I was attached to last year with regard to this topic and who has a lot to do with European Public Prosecutor's Office, with the original idea. I would just say in one amendment to myself that I'm in the first place a criminal lawyer, but with interest in EU law as well, which you have to have if you focus on a subject like the European Public Prosecutor's Office. I also know, because I took part 2 days ago at the panel discussions, that the EPPO, the European Public Prosecutor's Office, is not the most burning issue possibly currently in the relations of the UK and the EU. Nevertheless, the larger picture where the EPPO is a part of is a burning issue for several decades now. In the European Union, this is how to fight budgetary fraud. It has several aspects, as I said. It has it poses questions on approximation of substantive law, of procedure law, of on mutual recognition measures. And one aspect of this is an institutional aspect, and this is the possible setting up of a prosecution service at European level to fight fraud. The outline of today's talk would be as you can see. First of all, I would like to talk a bit about the background, the problem, which is the transnational, which is the prosecution in a transnational context of budgetary fraud. Then I would talk a bit about a project which was proposed in 1997, some solutions, how it might could be tackled, the problems. And this was the first proposal which mentioned the European Public Prosecutor. And then I would talk about the treaty basis, which was laid down in the Lisbon Treaty several years later, and about two important, more recent aspects, the Commission's proposal from 2013, and the latest state of negotiations, which the latest draft came out end of December last year under the Luxembourg presidency. So in the beginning, I told you that I would just mention some characteristics of budgetary fraud. Budgetary fraud is one thing sure, is a reality. The scale of budgetary fraud, fraud against the European Union's financial interest and budget, is not that the scale of it, you can't quantify very precisely, because there are no accurate data, nor at national level and at union level as well. This means that many member states do not have any specific data on budgetary fraud, and on the union level, Olaf, the union's anti-fraud office publishes its annual report on fraud every year, but it relies on the data which was submitted by the member states, which means that some member states don't have any data on it, others are not really willing to report fraud against the EU budget. There is also a problem that under a threshold, below a threshold of 10,000 euros of irregularities do not have to be reported to Olaf. So you can see that the picture narrows, actually, and Olaf and the Union has to work with these data that they receive from the member states. The problem, however, is that if you want to take actions at union level, you have to have reliable data and reliable evidence that there is a need for actions at union level. So this is the first problem. Second problem is, which is not a problem, but a characteristic of this budgetary fraud, that it is increasingly happens in a transnational way. Organized group of people committing budgetary fraud cross-border in an organized manner. This means, because it has a transnational characteristics, that it touches upon multiple jurisdictions, which requires active cooperation between the member states. And we will see on the next slide why it is sometimes very difficult to cooperate between the member states. A third aspect that I would mention with regard to budgetary fraud, that member states try to avoid as much as possible transnational investigations and prosecutions, and mostly focusing on the national dimension of this fraud. So only those parts which directly touch upon the national budget as well. If there is a prosecution, if there is an investigation into transnational budgetary fraud cases, there are several problems that occur. Three of the biggest problems are the strong asymmetry of the legal systems with regard to prosecution policies. There are member states who mandatorily prosecute the cases. Others have discretionary reasons not to prosecute or allow that for that. There are significant differences in the substantive criminal laws and in the criminal procedures of the member states. You have to think about, with regard to the substantive criminal law, of the definition of the related offenses, time limitation periods, liability of corporations. There are several differences in the substantive criminal laws. And on the side of the procedural law, we have to mention that several studies already showed that there are huge differences what kind of investigative measures are there for the prosecution services to use them during an investigation, what are the conditions of using coercive measures in investigations, what kind of procedural safeguards apply for these investigations. And if there are huge differences in these aspects, that leads to the fact that actually member states are not really keen on cooperating in transnational cases of fraud, because the lack of mutual trust in the criminal legislation of the other member states. Nevertheless, because the problem is that there were first steps at union level to somehow tackle the problem and protect the financial interests of the union. First, I would mention the Greek Mage judgment from 89, and it ruled that there should be effective measures to stop budgetary fraud. This was implemented later in Article 280 of the Treaty on the Establishment of the European Communities, and not just required that effective measures should be taken, but also the so-called principle of equivalence, that it should be the same measures as the member state would apply against offenses which attach upon the national budget. So it's not just about effective measures, but they have to be the same kind of measures with regard to union budgetary fraud and national fraud. A third step was, and this is actually the legal framework, current legal framework where it all started, was 95, the PIF Convention, the Convention on the Protection of the European Community's Financial Interests, which tried to define offenses and sanctions with regard to these types of crimes, which should apply in the member states. As you can see, it was adopted under Maastricht, which means an intergovernmental mechanism with all its shortcomings, meaning that all member states had to ratify the convention, and which took a long time. 2002 was the convention ratified finally. And the member states had to implement the provisions in the convention, and later impact assessments showed that only five member states actually implemented fully the provisions of the PIF convention. That shows actually that there is a PIF convention, but it didn't have too much of an impact on harmonizing the relevant provisions in the member states. Unsatisfied with this state of affairs in the late 90s or middle of the 90s, actually, the Commission launched a project. It was called the Single Legal European Single Legal Area Project. And one of its main tasks was to invent a scheme how to tackle transnational in a transnational context EU budgetary fraud. The drafters came up with the results, which was the short name of its Corpus Juris, and Professor John Spencer was part of the drafting committee, and it was quite a revolutionary concept because it tried to shift the balance from harmonization to unification, meaning that it proposed a single set of offenses when fighting budgetary fraud, a common set of rules of procedures and evidence, which should establish a single legal area. So what we have to know about the Corpus Juris is that it tries to establish a single legal area whenever it comes to the criminal law protection against budgetary fraud. And the basis for this are unified rules all around the member states, only for these offenses. This is the study which also proposed the European Public Prosecutor, way back it was called the European Public Prosecutor, to help the uniform application of these unified rules all around Europe, because the jurisdiction would have been the territory of the member states, and to provide for coherent prosecution policy. What we have to know about the EPP, that this study envisaged a European Public Prosecutor with a small central office in Brussels or wherever, and delegated prosecutors in all member states, which work together. So a vertical structure. One more thing to the proposal, that in the trial phase, so it wouldn't have stopped at the prosecution stage, but it would have gone to the trial phase as well, to the national courts, where the EPP would have presented the case together with the national prosecutors. So it would be one more guarantee that the case will be followed up. It's not just starting prosecution, but it will be followed up in front of the national courts. An important aspect of the study was that the final judgments in front of the national courts in these cases would have had would have been valid all over Europe afterwards. The imaginative aspects of this study could be summarized in the following way. As I mentioned, it moved from harmonization to unification of rules. It established a special regime for a single legal area, and it had also two very interesting ideas. One was a European warrant for arrest. The original idea comes from here. The European Public Prosecutor would have been able, according to this study, to issue European warrants for arrest, which would have been then valid all around the member states. It seemed at the time, 1997, as a political or academic science fiction, but a few years later, actually, after 9/11, it was the first framework decision which was adopted, the European arrest warrant, for a much broader scale of offences, not just for budgetary fraud. The other very imaginative aspect was the validity and enforceability of final decisions, which, if you look at the later framework decisions as well, we can see them in later framework decisions which required the final, which required the mutual recognition of final decisions. The reactions to this study varied. The member states were quite reluctant to think about a central European prosecution service, mainly because of it would touch heavily upon attributes of national sovereignty, giving up national prosecutorial powers of deciding when, for what, and who to prosecute in these cases. So the member states tried to push more horizontal approaches, just like mutual recognition measures, and also setting up Eurojust in 2002, which is the European Union's Judicial Cooperation Unit. This is a unit which acts clearly upon a horizontal basis. It has a college with national members, and the national members from the member states are governed by national rules and national mandate and financed by the member states as well. So it doesn't have, even though it's the European Union's unit, it doesn't have a European quality in that sense. The Commission was not reluctant to the idea, actually it followed it up. There was another corpus juris study and a green paper as well, so they didn't let go the idea, but it would, in the following years, it was a bit more silent around the EPPO. It changed with the Lisbon Treaty, and this is my third point, which established quite a broad framework how to fight budgetary fraud. And as I told you, it has several aspects: substantive criminal law, procedural law, mutual recognition measures. And I just wanted to show up in the treaty context which provisions deal with the financial interests of the EU and fighting them. And down on the slide, you see that there's an institutional aspect. Finally, the Lisbon Treaty introduced the possibility to establish the EPPO. Please don't faint. This is the provision itself, so you don't have to read it. But I just wanted to have it on the slide. It's not the whole provision at all, but I can summarize it for you. The treaty provides for the possibility to establish the EPPO upon a unanimous decision to investigate, prosecute, and bring into judgment of the respective offenses. It should be established, according to the treaty, from Eurojust. And the treaty also provides for the possibility to establish the EPPO by enhanced cooperation. So at least 9 member states would go on with the idea that they can establish the public prosecutor's office. So we have a legal basis in the treaty, and there are more questions than answers in the provision, as always, because most of the questions, which you can see now, the issues here on the slide, were not dealt within the treaty, but a regulation should work out all these questions. The main questions are: what would be the material scope of competence for the EPPO, what kind of powers it would have around Europe, the institutional design, is it a vertical solution, is it a horizontal approach, the applicable law, whether EU rules will be applied or more the national rules, the EPPO's relation to the existing framework already, as I mentioned, OLAF and Eurojust are already operating, and the judicial control over the acts of the EPPO. So these were questions the academic literature dealt with in the following years. And I just want to go to one aspect of it, the institutional design and the applicable law. There were 3 main theoretical models how it could operate. And you can see B is the maximum model, which would have been a centralized EPPO, meaning that at the center in somewhere in Europe, there is a European Public Prosecutor's Office operating upon European rules and could investigate and prosecute these crimes all over Europe. Naturally, it would have meant huge political resistance by the member states. The other end would have been a collegiate model, which means that national members, just like in the case of Eurojust, would form a central level, gathering evidence upon national rules, deciding over cases how to initiate investigations and prosecutions. So it wouldn't have touched upon national sovereignty. And the third model, which was advocated already by the corpus juris, is the integrated model, meaning that we have at central level a European body working mostly upon European rules, and it has delegates in each member state, and these delegates are enforcing the decisions of the central level. So the 2 big questions actually were what is the right level of Europeanization when this model should be established, and how dangerous it would be to rely too much upon the national laws. So these were the two main questions, and the Commission came up with its proposal in 2013 with the following proposals. The material scope of the competence of the EPPO was not defined in the proposal itself, but it referred to another proposal, to the PIF directive, which should replace the PIF convention, which I talked about previously. So the offences defined in the PIF directive would be the base for the material competence of the EPPO. The problem with this solution is that the directive itself has to be implemented in the national member states as well, which wouldn't once again solve the problem that within the between the member states there are different definitions for the same offences with different content. The EPPO, according to this proposal, would have had exclusive competence over these cases. The proposal listed a lot of investigative measures which would be which the EPPO could use. The problem was that it's only a list of investigative measures, and all the detailed rules were left for the national with the national laws. It means that in the list there is that the EPPO should be able to conduct search and seizures, but what the detailed rules of this measure is are decided by the competent national law where the investigation takes place. Comparative studies in the meantime and also before that already showed that there are huge differences between not just what kind of measures are available for the prosecution services in the member states, but also what kind of procedural safeguards apply. For that reason also about the admissibility of evidence. So for example, if in one member state there are strong procedural safeguards with regarding gathering evidence, but more easy safeguards for the admissibility of evidence, that's not a problem as long as this evidence circulates within this one member state. But at the moment when several member states meet, it's a transnational case, and if two member states have a case together where the balance is different, so in the other member states the gathering of evidence has easy safeguards and the admissibility is very strong, then in the when these two systems meeting together, it could result both in it could be both detrimental and both very beneficial for a defendant at the end. The structure the Commission proposed is relies on actually on the corpus juris structure, so a vertical structure with a center office and delegated prosecutors in the member states. It didn't touch upon the question of the relations of the EPPO on those member states who won't be members of the EPPO. This is a bit surprising actually, because given the positions of, for example, Denmark, UK, Ireland, it is quite sure that they won't participate later in the EPPO. Also, given that the treaty itself provides for the possibility of enhanced cooperation, it also shows that it's very possible that the EPPO, if ever established, won't be upon a unanimous decision. And finally, the judicial control of the EPPO Act is also a very interesting concept, or a strange one, because the proposal says that because of the EPPO acts upon national laws and national courts authorize its actions, for the judicial control of the EPPO's acts, the EPPO should be regarded as a national authority, which is a quite interesting concept, actually. They just wanted to get rid of the question, I have the feeling, how to control the EPPO, because the EPPO, one thing is sure, if it will be established, it won't be a national authority. The main purpose is to solve problems in transnational cases, so in the most of the cases, it will definitely touch upon different interests, conflicting interests of member states. So it's not... it's not clear as yet, because the negotiations are still on how the judicial control at the end will look like, but currently it's not the best concept presented. I already commented on the Commission's proposal, so I just want to emphasize here that what was interesting with the Commission's proposal, that it somehow lost the focus of the original focus, and it's not focusing anymore on creating a European, a truly European prosecution service, but more on how to integrate this service in the national laws. So it's actually the original problem somehow shifted during the negotiations, mostly because of the endless compromises with the member states. The member states naturally were not happy with the Commission's proposal, so it was the second case ever as yet that the yellow card was triggered under the early warning mechanism. And the member states questioned the necessity of actions at union level and also the added value of the EPPO. They questioned it on grounds of the inaccuracy of the figures that were presented in the impact assessment. But I already told you that the OLAF figures are not can be accurate. The lack of new powers were criticized, which is also clear because if the EPPO has to rely on those investigative powers which are available in each member state, then it is at the end just a replication of the powers and there are no new genuine powers for the EPPO. And thirdly, the opinions of several national parliaments criticized that given that the Commission did not address the question of non-participating member states, if the EPPO would be established, that would mean that resources from OLAF would be allocated to the EPPO, clearly, and Eurojust would lose competence in certain over certain offences, which would be detrimental at the end on the relations of non-EPPO member states with these two European bodies. And at the end, it would hinder their efforts to fight budgetary fraud. Nevertheless, the Commission maintained the proposal as it was. Since then, and this is the final point, we got into December last year, where the Luxembourg presidency also presented a draft. Before that, already the Greek and the Italian presidencies introduced changes to the Commission concept. The two most important changes that they introduced, that it should be not exclusive competence of the EPPO anymore, but shared competence between the member states and the EPPO. And the other important change introduced was that the EPPO should have a college model. So the Luxembourg presidency last year confirmed these changes and introduced an increased complexity of the model. Now we have a college, in the latest draft at least, at the European level, with one European public prosecutor from each member state, meaning that, yeah, with the highest number, but naturally some members are not in, but it could be also 28 European public prosecutors at European level. And this college would be mostly responsible for strategic questions. There would be within the college permanent chambers, which would decide in the individual cases. Then there would be the EPPs from each member state and the delegated prosecutors enforcing the decisions at national level. As you can see, we started with the Corpus Juris study with one European public prosecutor, and now we have a huge, significant enlargement at the central level already. With regard to the structure, I just want to mention one thing, that even though it is a college, it should be a mistake to say that it's just a replication of Eurojust, because Eurojust also have a college. But what is clear, that even though it should work upon a very complicated college structure, according to the latest draft, the decisions that the EPPO would take would be European decisions. The rules would be European rules, they would be financed by the EU, so there's a huge difference between the Eurojust college and the EPPO college. I would also highlight that with regard to the competences of the EPO, there are some counteractions as well, which could lead that several cases get lost in the system. For example, the latest draft provides for not just that the EPPO has competences of the PIF offences, but also so-called inextricably linked other offences, which were functional to commit the PIF offence itself. Nevertheless, there are exceptions. For example, in the draft says if the damage caused is higher for another victim, then the EPPO would and should evoke the case back to national level, which means we have a PIF case, we have EPPO competence, but nevertheless, at the end, it would get back to the national level again, where we have the same problems as in the beginning. We can't be really sure whether it will be prosecuted at the end or not. For example, in a member state which doesn't have mandatory prosecution. I just lost where I can hear, okay. Finally, the investigative powers and the relations to other actors in the latest draft. There are still no uniform powers. Actually, the investigative powers of the list of the investigative powers continually was cut back in the presidency drafts. And as I already mentioned before, it will have huge impact on the positions of the defendants. And the recognition of the evidence produced under foreign law. So if we have no uniform powers for the EPPO, then it means that it will act under different rules in different member states. The delegated prosecutors will have different powers in the different member states. So it not just different powers, but also different procedural safeguards. And we are back to the original problem, how to recognize this evidence produced under foreign law with these shortcomings and handicaps. Finally, the relations to other actors in the draft. There is one I would emphasize because I was asked in the, before that about non-EPPO member states and third states. With regard to third states, actually, the delegated prosecutors could be of use because in the draft they have a double hat model, meaning that they can act both under European authority and under the national obligations. And for example, if there would be a case with with third states, it could be possible that the EPPO could work together with third states under the national hat of the delegated prosecutors. So I asked in the beginning whether it's a Trojan horse or a white elephant. And Trojan horse naturally tried to refer to the original problem of giving up attributes of national sovereignty, and the EPPO was seen as a danger for that. And white elephant, at the end, as we see, the structure became so complex and there are no real solutions provided as yet to overcome the fragmentation of the national laws, which means that even though, as you can see on these slides, we will have binding European decisions, this is provided by the drafts. We have European decision, even if it's very complicated in the current structure. But the problem is that the other original problem, the fragmentation of the national laws, is not solved. And therefore, the efficiency of the EPPO in its current form in the drafts is questionable. Thank you very much.